Welcome to this episode of Trouble in Paradise, your only podcast for detailed breakdowns of the George Lopez Show, episode by episode. I am one of your hosts, Kyle, and I'm not the only one loco for Lopez. I'm joined by my very own Ernie, you might say, my co-host, Tim. Tim, how are you doing today?
I'm doing quite well. It's that time of the week that we're here to talk some G-Lo, so I'm pretty excited.
Yeah. How's the weather out there in San Diego?
It's pretty nice. It's about 70 and sunny.
That is nice.
Can't complain.
Yeah, it's like 93 in like hell in upstate New York. Well, I'm glad you're having a good day. It's nice weather. Because I got some bad news, buddy. I'm sorry to do this to you. I mean, you just ignore the people on the bottom of our shared screen there. Some bad news for you.
We're going to run out of time to talk about George Lopez again?
Yeah, we're not going to be able to talk about the episode of George Lopez after a horrible dinner that features a drunk Carmen, Max with a hickey on his neck, other dirty secrets about the town, but it still convinces the Lopez family that California is still the place for them. We actually have a really good episode. Very excited. We're joined by a creative team behind one of my new favorite books, Everyone is Tulip, TikTok star Dave Baker, and winner of the DC Kids Batgirl Draw-Off, Nicole Gu. How are you guys doing today?
Good. I think that's the best introduction we've gotten so far.
Yeah. My 200 TikTok followers, thank you for recognizing my fame and infamy that has been generated on that lovely app.
Exactly. And I was very impressed by your title streak, Nicole, with Sarah, right?
Yeah.
You beat those fucking kids. Those kids are fucking losers.
Yeah, they didn't stand a chance.
let's put these kids against a professional artist and an adult writer, which will be down in the game dictionary. But yes, we're here to talk about Everyone is Tulip, which is out. Is it? I should have looked. This is great podcasting. Dark Horse Comics is out this.
It 16th? Comes out. Yeah, it comes out the 16th in comic book stores and 29th in bookstores.
So 2 weeks.
2 weeks. And so you guys have talked about this for a bit, and we kind of knew about it. And I knew about the other one you were working on. And just like this book was so interesting to me. And the fact that it's coming out on Dark Horse, which I think is even more interesting. Kind of before we started, we were talking about putting any comics or different types of comics in the hands of people who generally are, you know, Wednesday warriors making their way in there. And this even feels like kind of a little bit different from what we've seen from Dark Horse in the majority of the time. Normally I'll start with like, what was the genesis for this? And then how did that kind of come about for Dark Horse? Again, this book is very much more a tone and a theme and a larger idea than it is like kind of just like a straight plot, I would say.
It's not a Hellboy book, so it's surprising that Dark Horse is publishing it.
Yeah, I didn't know how it fit in. I was halfway through, and I decided Lobster Johnson's not here. I don't know.
Yeah. Originally, it started as one of the broader BPRD universe books, but then ultimately we decided, you know what, the cameos really impacted the characters' growth, so we decided to pull them back and save them for the next one. Everyone is Tulip 2, the ghost of Frankenstein's vampire's robot's best friend.
Everyone is rescued.
Yeah. Liz. Everyone is BPRD. That'll be the next.
Everyone is Hellboy.
Everyone is Hellboy. Yeah. No, but the book kind of started because a couple years ago, Nicole and I really we got into this subculture. These weird YouTube performance artists that had kind of all bubbled up at the same point in time, and we had finished Fuck Off Squad, which was put out by Silver Sprocket, and then we started trying to sort out what we were going to do next. What was the next book? And Nicole got really into some of these people, and I got really into some of these people, and we kind of ended up taking some real life events that happened to them, mixing it with some original stuff, and then kind of making a story that's all about kind of compromise and how far are you willing to go to get what you want? The book is about a young actor who moves from Arizona to Los Angeles to try and make it in the world of Hollywood, and then gets sucked up into the high stakes world of YouTube performance art and becomes a viral sensation overnight, and it kind of changes her world.
And the way that it kind of got brought into Dark Horse is that Dave and I really kind of, I think we pitched the book around a little bit, didn't get much of a response. There was one publisher that we were thinking about working with, but for numerous reasons decided not to. And then, you know, Dave and I do lots of conventions, and at a show, I want to say maybe Emerald City, our editor from Dark Horse, Connor Knudsen, came up, and I think his roommate had given him Fuck Off Squad or one of our other books, and he really liked it. And he was like, hey, I really enjoyed this book. What do you guys have anything else like this? Are you working on something similar? Do you have any pitches? And at that point, we were probably about halfway through the book already. And so we took it to Connor and said, hey, what do you think about this? And Connor really was kind of a champion in getting that book accepted at Dark Horse. We also kind of lucked out in that our timing worked out that they are doing a push into the book market with single story OGNs. And so the story that we wanted to tell fit really well in kind of this new line that they're experimenting with at Dark Horse.
And I think, I mean, I know you guys have talked about this a lot, kind of the idea of what are graphic novels, what are comics, what are just kind of the general structure of single storytelling. And I think something like this, where, like you say, being pitched as a graphic novel, but sensibly one long comic, but working in this long form, you guys approach this very interestingly, I think, storytelling wise, plotting wise. There's a lot of kind of time jumps. There's a lot of kind of out of sequence in the sense in the way you approach the moments that happen and how they hit. Was that difficult in a story where, again, this is like very, I hate to say slice of life, but this is very much about, you know, personal growth, finding oneself, and these arcs of every character in there, but there's no like huge event, you know, New York doesn't explode in it. Like, these are all minor things that happen, and in the significance of the larger world, it doesn't matter. Like, none of this really matters to anybody else. It just matters to these people. Is that difficult plotting that out, especially you guys kind of the way you approach it? Or was that part of the idea of approaching that kind of disjointed timeline for the plot story?
Yeah. No, I don't think it was particularly hard, mostly because I feel like the term slice of life has a very specific connotation to it that I don't necessarily think is always applicable. Like, I think of this as like it's a drama, right? Like, it should have the feeling, our book kind of has the feeling of like a dog barking out there like that. Our book kind of has the feeling of like, you know, an independent film, you know, where there it's about character growth and compromise, right? So I think a lot of slice of life comics, when people hear that term, they think like Jeffrey Brown, Every Girl is the End of the World for Me, like kind of there is no plot or there is no arc. It's just like a little window in time. And our book isn't not that, but it's more of kind of like it's a drama about these people's lives and what they're going through, right? And I don't know about you guys, but I've never been through an explosion. So I wouldn't really necessarily, like, that wouldn't be my delineation of, like, an exciting story is, like, living through an explosion. Sure, it is. But for me, the questions at the center of the book are what's interesting, where it's you take all of these different characters from different walks of life and pit them against this idea, right? This, what is artistic compromise? How do you pay bills as an artist? What is that line that you're willing to cross in order to get to the next level? Because those are things that I think everybody relates to in one way or another, whether that's in relationships, whether that's professionally, like everyone has dealt with that struggle at one point or another. And that those were kind of the things that Nicole and I were interested in interrogating. And the jumping around in time almost kind of came organically from those questions, where it was like, what's the most interesting way to tell this component or this building block in this character's progression towards whether they will or will not make the ultimate compromise or whatever.
I actually think initially, you know, because initially we had some, not debate, but we were considering doing it as issues because we didn't know who we were going to publish with, how they'd want to do it. And I think it would have been significantly harder to do it that way based on the type of story that it is, because there's no explosions, because there's no big event in every chapter. because it's a little bit slower paced and meditative. Doing it as a single one-shot story just gives you the space to do that without making sure you have like a stinger every 22 pages.
Well, talking about the way that you are releasing it, what went into putting it up online for free?
Yeah, so it's a combination of things. One of them being that we don't get to do cons this year at all. And that is one of the main ways that Dave and I get our books out to people. So we go to 20 cons a year and hand sell our books. That's how we know how to get the word out about it. And since that wasn't available to us this year, we knew that we were going to have to find other ways to get the word out about the book. And I think there is some stigma sometimes when you give something away for free. People think that, oh, well, if you're giving it away for free, people won't pay for it. You're not going to make money back. You're not going to do this or that. And I actually don't see it that way at all. I think it's really just a way for people to get a, you know, preview of the book, to get a feel for the book. If they want to read it all online, that's great. Most of the people who are going to go out and buy the book will do it either way. And the people who are not going to do it might not have read it at all. So you're getting new readers who you wouldn't have had in the first place because they weren't going to buy the book. So obviously there's a lot of talk about piracy in the comics industry, and it's very kind of hot button issue. But this way we kind of sidestep that conversation entirely because we've put that out there for people to read if they want to. I really think it's a good way. And for us, you know, because we don't have a book tour or anything like that, it's a way for us to talk about the book consistently and say like, hey, we have new pages up this week, and be able to say that without just repeating ourselves over and over again in a way that is significant to readers and is giving people actual new information.
Yeah, I think one of the things, I mean, a lot of the, obviously the issue of piracy in comics, and I would say significantly with something like the Big Two, where those are kind of where people are devoting a lot of their time. But it's always because comics is such, the fan base behind comics, I think for the most part, is still very physical media heavy, that like doing that, giving people a taste of it, or even just giving people the ability to read it, most of the people go out and still kind of purchase it because they want it on their shelves. They want to share it with people. It's such a unique kind of fan base that a majority of the time, I mean, obviously there's people who read digitally, but like even I, a lot of the way I use to look for new books is to quickly go on scan sites and look and say like, okay, I need to go pick this up, and like kind of use that as a I don't know, almost like DeviantArt was back in the day. Like use that to find the thing. It's such a vast market, but it's such a medium. And as I have 7 full bookshelves of fucking garbage, like I like physical media. So like you give people that and they do it. And like we were talking about, like exposing people who generally wouldn't maybe have saw it because they're not going to buy it anyway unless they see it. So like, you know, someone's not going to walk into their local comic book and see this on the shelf unless they either flip through it or they see it online. And luckily that's kind of, I think, happened over the last year, and you guys doing that with Everything Is Two of, I think, has helped that again tremendously with the book.
Yeah, and like one of the things that we've run into repeatedly over the course of doing these interviews is like people who probably wouldn't have picked up the book but are hosting the podcast, so they read the book to talk with us, being very enthusiastic about it and like really genuinely being like, you know, I probably wouldn't have picked this up, but obviously I had to read it to talk to you about it, and like it's awesome and I'm gonna recommend it to all my friends, and like it's such a,
and I'm gonna buy it. So we give these people full PDFs of the book, and they say I read it cover to cover and now I'm gonna go out and buy it. So I think, like you said, it is a very specific audience with kind of a collector's mentality. So if they like the book, I think, you know, they're gonna invest in it, and I hope that people will think of it as investing in creators. Not just us, but everyone, you know.
Yeah.
Well, especially too. I mean, someone like Dark Horse and trying out a new line. Oh, go ahead, Tim.
No, I was gonna make a stupid joke. Go, Kyle.
I mean, I would also say before you start is that we did this with Dark Horse's blessing. So we're not sidestepping anyone. We got this approved by our marketing team, and they were totally cool with kind of seeing this as an experiment, which we were doing as well, to see, like, does this work? Does this help us? Does it make us lose sales? It's kind of hard to gauge because it's not like we would really know what the sales would be without it, but
yeah.
And that's like I said, like with Dark Horse trying something new out, like, do we want to do these type of comics, these more one shots, these more character focused books? Like, again, supporting that is the show to Dark Horse that those things work versus, again, reading it and be like, oh, I like it, but I'm not going to go buy it. Like, then that doesn't, you don't, you're kind of negating what you're doing by reading it.
Yeah. I mean, and a large percent of the part, large component of this conversation too is that, like, you know, Dark Horse publishes stuff all over the map, but they're primarily known for publishing a couple things, right? It's probably, like, if you're aware of them as a publisher, it's probably Hellboy, Black Hammer, some Sin City, right? That's probably what you know. And, like, this is a perfect, our book is a perfect opportunity for them to put their feet into the YA boom that's happening right now, the more female-centric graphic novel thing that's happening with books like Motor Crush and Snot Girl, and, like, there's so many things happening in different components of the comic book industry, and it feels like none of them talk to each other. Like, the book market people only read book market things, web comic people only read web comic things, and direct market people only read superheroes. Like, it's this weird thing. Like, I read everything. I love all types of comics, and so, you know, Dark Horse doing this is exciting to me on multiple fronts. You know, like, it's exciting on a logistical front, it's exciting personally because Nicole and I made this book that we deeply believe in, and to have a company with the legacy and track record of Dark Horse, like, vouch for us and sign us up and, you know, not screw us over, let us own the book like so many other publishers wouldn't do, is really cool. And I'm very excited to see what happens. And honestly, like, there's kind of nowhere to go but up. Like, you know, like, if it doesn't sell that well, I guarantee you it's going to sell better than the self-published comics we made. And if it does sell really well, fuck yeah, let's make some more. You know what I mean? Like, I'm saying this because I'm attempting to internalize what I know to be true and yet still have a very hard time accepting. It's a good time.
Well, my last book did have a bat on it, so...
Exactly.
It might not be as many sales as that.
No, but, like, you know, her last book had a bat on it, which means that there will be hopefully some new people looking at our thing. That's fucking awesome. So, yeah. That's great. Right.
Well, and even, I mean, so DC puts out these, like, little, this is great podcasting. These, like, little, and they're like the adventure stuff. And in the back of this one, Shadow of the Bat, it has a preview.
Hey!
So my son read this. He reads all these. And then he came into my office this afternoon, and he saw I had this up. And he's like, oh, I know that book. Can I read it, Dad? And I was like, I think so. I think you can read it. He's 7. But then he's like, why do you have that up there? And I was talking to him. Yeah.
There's a couple cuss words and some violence, but... it's like mostly fine.
Yeah, he's raised in this household. That's not it. That's my general conversation. But then so he saw that. He's like, can I read that? And then he asked me why I had it up. And I was like, oh, I'm talking to the artist, Nicole, and we're about this other book. And he's like, oh, what is that book? And then I was telling him about that book. And so, like, even as a 7-year-old, he kind of made the leaps to other things. And yeah. And, like, we're big on, like, I make sure he knows every creator on it, and then how they, like, we were reading Dave Pilkey, and he used to do the Cat Kong books, but he has the Captain Underwear, and he's forgot that. But that's a whole other fucking thing with kids. But to kind of lead into another question I had, talking about the young adult market, and like I said, I read tons of that. I read a lot of the even kind of younger for kids. I think an episode I'm doing next week, which I didn't tell Tim about if he wants to, because it's a kids one, but Chad Sell, he does the Cardboard Kingdom series, and I think Doodleville. But those are fun, and my kids like them, and I like reading them. But they do, like, different stuff, and we talked about this with Nicole with Shadow of the Bat. I feel like the young adult market is experimenting more, whether it is DC, whether it is Scholastic. Like, they're trying different types of storytelling. They're tackling current hurdles to storytelling. And one thing you guys do in this book is the hurdle of how do you approach social media, not only its effect on people, but also how do we show that visually in a comic? And obviously, I think Nicole does it beautifully in the way you kind of approach the layouts, working it into the screen. But was that a challenge? Was that a real focus for you guys? Kind of obviously how to approach it, but also it's so important to the story, and it is like crux of like how it affects Becca. Was that a challenge and for you guys at all, both in visually and plot wise?
I wouldn't necessarily call it a challenge so much as something that's really interesting for us, because Dave and I, one of the things that we find most exciting about comics is finding new ways to tell stories and ways that are kind of essential to the comics medium. So some of the stuff, the depictions of the internet stuff comes from Dave. Some of it comes from me. Some of it's brainstorming together. But, you know, we had started this idea of phones as panels, particularly in the 9-panel grid as an X or a diamond, in Fuck Off Squad, in the last issue of the Fuck Off Squad books. And that's something that played really well into our new topic, which was social media. So there's a lot of phones as panels. I got to play around with this, which is the page I was about to talk about, which is Instagram likes and scrolling and different ways to show that. And one of the things that I think for me works most effectively is this idea that I came up with, a color palette of everything, everywhere the internet is represented, it is this different color. It's this light blue, and it feels, it's supposed to have this otherworldly kind of ethereal look and feel that is just really different from the grounded colors of the rest of the book. And all of those things play into each other. And that's an idea that I kind of came up with, but Ellie Hall, our colorist, executed it beautifully. And she did an amazing job really kind of dividing the book into these two parts of, this is the world of the internet, which is a completely separate space from our real world that we live in, and how those things are different and how they interact. So it was fun. I think for us, it's just fun to play around with ways of showing that.
Yeah, so many fucking comics are boring, man. Like, I don't know what these dudes are doing, fucking asleep at the wheel, but so many comics are just three panels on a page, and it's like, bro, come on. It's fine to do that for one page, but come on, man. Let's make some weird shit. Let's use the, like, formalist aspects of the medium. Let's make a comic that's endemically and inherently a comic first, not some shitty illustrated screenplay published by some intellectual property gangster trying to flip something to Hollywood.
And well, in social media, like the way we view it, and generally either on screens or you think of like TikTok or you think of Instagram, like those are like those themselves, you're building panels. Like those are the way we view that. So working it into comics more, which we don't see a lot of, I think it's a next step into that progressively. Like even I think film has struggled with it for a while. I think it's progressively gotten better on how you use it. Even movies like Cam or The Host recently, those were ones that kind of adapted it well, but like it is something we struggle with, but like it is so adept in our society to ignore it completely doesn't make any sense at all.
Mm-hmm. I feel like there's a lot of stories that sort of sidestep the reality that people are on their phones all the time, like that don't work if we acknowledge the fact that people have access to phones and 911 and whatever it is. And there's a lot of times when you see that kind of just being ignored, when I don't know that you can really tell a story in 2021, unless you're doing a period piece, without that as, for me, in at least in our story, it's a character. The internet itself is a separate character from the characters in the story. And the characters' personas through the internet are also separate characters. But we're all so affected by it at almost every moment of our lives. You really have to make an effort to step away in order to have a story or a moment without that affecting you in some way.
I think,
so are you drawing digitally so that you're constantly on, so are you drawing digitally so that you're constantly on one of these electronic devices connected to the internet.
Yeah, funny thing is I drew this book almost entirely digitally. So I am, I don't want to say part of the problem, but definitely affected by it just as much, if not more than anyone else. I've been trying to take a step back, but I spend a lot of my day staring at screens. And it's affected my eyesight and the way I interact with people completely. There's so many times when I'm like drawing on paper and I'll like double tap to undo. And I'm like, oh, this is so embarrassing.
Oh, yeah. That's 3 out of 4 with glasses already.
Yeah, I didn't used to have glasses like 3 years ago, just so you know.
To that, with drawing digitally, at least for this series and a lot of your stuff, I'm thinking of Shadow of the Bat, we talked about it a lot. This more than anything, it felt like you kind of experimented more with even panel to panel within it, like your presentation, either with faces, the level of detail you used. A lot of times, like Becca's almost represented with physically without a nose, but you represent it with kind of shade or contour or depth. Was that something on this, and even again, kind of digitally, is that allowing you more to kind of play more with shapes and stuff like that? And what works and pulling back less on it? Whereas, you know, if you're drawing physically sometime and you're like Dave, who's drawing a million fucking lines on a page, tough to erase at times. Does that at least allow you to kind of experiment more the way you're approaching kind of the simplicity of art?
So I did not do the color for the book. So any color decisions other than the like broader sense of like, I wanted the internet to be blue, or I kind of designed the palette of the overall book, but any of the individual decisions and really like rendering of the story, that's all Ellie Hall. She did a fantastic job and those are her decisions. I would say that drawing digitally completely allows me to be more experimental because I have the ability to undo and change things and move stuff around and try different brushes without the commitment of actual ink or Dave's heavy hand, which I have a pretty heavy hand actually when I draw traditionally as well. And the main thing I would say about drawing digitally is that for me, it allows me to make the pages the way that I see them in my head, because I can move things around, because I can change it. You know, I am someone who's been drawing my entire life, but I don't have the skills to do things perfect every time. I don't have the skills to see it in my head and just translate it, you know, one for one. And a lot of the time I figure out that stuff, what the page needs to be, or new ways of shading or putting something in perspective or doing this, I figure that out on the page while I'm doing it. And it allows me to experiment in a way I probably would have been more hesitant to do drawing traditionally.
I think I think it was the last interview we did that's not up yet, but we were talking about, I think, artists kind of learning to get over the fear of the eraser and like always feeling like when you put it down, like it needs to be right. And if it's not right, I'm not doing it right. Like, but I can't erase it. But the ability to erase and mess with things and just kind of the freedom and looseness of that, it inhibits more creative freedom, but also like it helps you get what you want out of your head versus kind of like the rigidity of like, this needs to be it the first time. If it's not, I don't know the fuck I'm doing. Like,
yeah. Do you find yourself getting stuck with that undo, double tapping for that undo button, trying to get the perfect line? Or
there is a definitely a perfectionist quality that if you're not careful, you can let that take over and you won't be satisfied ever until it's perfect. And with ink, that's the line, you got to do it. For me, it's less fear of the eraser and more that sometimes you draw something perfectly, but it's in the wrong place and you got to erase that nice drawing that you had and draw it, you know, maybe the face is too big, maybe it's too small, maybe it's too far to the right and you ran out of space or this or that. And then you have to try and replicate the satisfaction that you had with that drawing somewhere else. And never, I don't think a single time has it ever come out better that I've tried to redraw something.
Yeah, it's a mathematical impossibility. Yeah. It does, you can't do never. It better.
No.
Yeah.
It's awful.
Mm-hmm. It's the worst feeling. In fact, I've gotten to the point where when I have to do that, I'll end up, it'll actually take longer, where instead of erasing something, I'll trace the original drawing, then erase it, then put the trace drawing underneath it, and then retrace that trace drawing, trying to get that original thing to the place where it needs to be. And it's rarely as good, but at least in my head, I can justify that I've tried, even though I know that it won't be as good. I'm like, I'm still reaching for it, you know, still striving.
Unfortunately, anytime you trace something, it just loses some of the life. It's just the nature of the beast.
Mm-hmm. Completely.
How many times I've drawn and I'm like, all right, because you just doodle and be like, oh, fine, I love that. I want to put that here. And you're like, I didn't, how did Kyle draw that? Because this Kyle's a fucking idiot. Like, this Kyle is not talented. I mean, Kyle's not talented, but this one's less. So
yeah. My pencils are always better than my finals. Always. Because there is an energy and a looseness. Even if the anatomy's wrong and things are sort of weird and mushy and there's 10 lines where there should really only be one, they're always better. I always like them better. And it's something that I think is really frustrating as an artist to be like, well, I spent 10 hours on this page and the fucking 10-minute pencils I did are better than that. But then also you can't turn in the 10-minute pencils because things got blurred when you resize them and, you know, or they're just not finished, so you just can't show them. And it's this weird dichotomy. In fact, the book that I am working on now was an attempt to put something out that was basically just pencils, really rough, straight to ink, basically kind of thing. And I'm a control freak, and so I couldn't do it. And now it's like a fully drawn book.
Save it for the IDW artist edition. Everything is too up.
Yeah.
You guys have, I think, obviously kind of a fairly unique creative partnership. You guys have worked together for a long time on a lot of titles. This one in particular, it feels very visually driven, especially a lot of the storytelling aspects. I saw you guys when you were releasing the pages online, you were kind of doing the like conversations about them, the commentary. And there's the one panel I love, and you guys talked about it, where Becca's walking through her hallway and there's the progression of the her family portraits, and at the very end with her mom. And obviously, again, there's like tons of information dump happening just in those two panels. As a team, what was it like plotting this book out again, kind of Dave writing, but also being someone who's very adept at visual storytelling, but again, Nicole kind of carrying a lot of it with her art?
I mean, that moment that you're talking about where she's walking down the hallway is beat for beat what's in the script. So like sometimes all of the, not all, because it's still Nicole drawing it, like execution is everything, right? Like a comics script is just a blueprint. Like it's not like something you can just hand to anybody and get the same result. That's not the way the medium works. But that specific example that you cited was one that was, you know, as much 100% me as something in the book can be, because nothing in the book is 100% me, because it's at least 50% Nicole, if not more, because let's be real, everyone's showing up for Nicole's drawings. And the story itself, like, I would say that those visual mechanics that we're talking about, yeah, I think they do come pretty much equally from both of us. Like, half the time it's me being like, what if? And half the time it's Nicole being like, I got this idea. And so I think the balance is pretty 50-50 there. Aside from if you think one of them doesn't work, then it's Nicole's. And if you think work, then it's mine.
Right, yeah. I would say we both come up with ideas. There's some stuff that's specifically Dave. There's some stuff that's specifically me. Like I said, there's some stuff that we talk about and kind of formulate together. There is a full script, though, with a panel breakdown. And aside from a couple pages here and there where I'll add a page or come up with an idea or this or that, it's mostly broken down panel for panel the way that Dave has written it. But that being said, there's almost no panel direction for me to work off. There's, you know, scene descriptions, there's this or that, but he's not directing the camera. He's not making those types of decisions, because when Dave and I work on a script together, we kind of know each other so well that I don't really need that. I know I can direct the scene as long as I have as long as I know where the dialogue, as long as I know what the characters are feeling, as long as I know kind of what the environment is, I will lead the eye in the way that I need to. And so occasionally there's a reason for him to be like, this should be a low A. I can't even think of a single time you were like, this should be from this.
Yeah, it's really just like every once in a while I'll be like, close up on so-and-so.
Sure, yeah.
Or like, you know, they're walking into a room and this is what's in the room and this is the stuff that's going on. And then the panels are more broken down into like, all right, Becca is on the other side of the room and then this is what she's saying. And then Eve is going over here and this is what she's saying. Like, it's very, very simple, you know, like I think one of them was like, in the first chapter, one of the directions was like, Eve is doing yoga, listening to Spotify on her phone and has her laptop open and has, you know, the TV on, because mm-hmm. the whole point was that like, even when there's not screens everywhere, everybody just has screens everywhere. But that's like, you know, that's the most, and sometimes the directions don't even make sense to anyone that wouldn't be Nicole. Like sometimes the directions literally are like, the scene direction is like, all right, so do the Nicole Goo sad girl at the beach stuff here. And like, she knows what that means. She knows that mean like that. I think that's literally what I wrote for one of the pages where Becca goes up into the Hollywood Hills and has this kind of like romantic rendezvous with the producer of the videos that she's in. And there's this kind of like, she's a small town girl and she's finally in the big city and she's theoretically about to go into this wider world and living her dreams. And she's in this big mansion and she's on the veranda in the back looking out over the glittering lights of, you know, Los Angeles. And I wrote something along those lines of like, do the Nicole Goo wind in the hair stuff here. And then Nicole fucking knocked it out of the park. And I think she turned it into like a 3-page scene where it's like Becca and then Stanley comes out, they have a conversation, and then they kind of in this kind of like bittersweet moment kind of have their first romantic entanglement out on this moonlit courtyard. And like, I wrote some of that stuff, but I wrote the like, all right, she's in the backyard, he comes out, they have this dialogue, and then they kiss. And then she turned it into this just whole other thing. Like, sometimes when I write for people, it really is more like I'm directing them, like I'm walking them through what's happening and trying to facilitate their or compensate for maybe the things that they're not as solid in. With Nicole, I think it's probably more similar to what a screenwriting director relationship is, where I write the thing and then she makes the thing. And I, every once in a while, she'll be like, what do you think of this? And then I'm like, I don't know, this thing over here is a little weird. Oh, okay, I'm not going to change that. And then 2 days later, what do you think of the same thing? But now that thing that you mentioned has changed and neither one of us say anything about it. And I go, oh yeah, it looks good.
I would never do that. I don't know what you're talking about. Never.
But like that's
I might have a little bit of a pride issue, okay?
But like that's the most that there's back and forth. Back and forth in a bad way or a good way, just in terms of like, we've also like saying that it's in the script and like putting emphasis on the script doesn't really capture the creative process, because that's kind of not what we're doing. Like the script is just like this weird roadmap where it's like, all right, yeah, we both know what it needs to be, this and that, and then blah, 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 blah. But it really is like the books are made in the like conversations about theme and tone and the ideas that happen. Just like, you know, we'll be at her house fucking eating pizza at midnight watching fucking Star Trek or some shit. And I'm like, but what if? And then she goes, no, we're not doing that. That's too much work. It's too much work. And then 2 days later, she'll text and be like, you know what? That's a really good idea. We should probably do that.
Sometimes it just takes time to digest.
Yeah.
Because your ideas can be like a range from like real simple, straightforward to like really out there. And sometimes they just need like some massaging.
They just need some time to stew in the old cauldron of the brain meat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we do this thing now. I think we started, I guess, probably 2 summers ago now. Where we go to this little mini park by my house and just play catch and talk about story. And we just did that the other day. And it really, like, you get the weirdest breakthroughs doing something like that. I don't know whether it's, like, the combination of the physical activity or the forced change of scenery. I don't know. It helps.
It really helps. Yeah. It also helps when you throw the ball at the other person's correct hand as opposed to their non-dominant hand. Which is something that I struggle with. I always throw it to the non-dominant hand.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So gotta be well, aware of where the glove is.
Don't get out and get a lot of exercise. So
yeah, I was gonna say we're all four of us are clearly super athletic. So
oh yeah, so tough.
We already knew that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Sports are hard. And I think it goes for, I mean, both of you have created your own work individually and have been part of other teams. And I think in general, I think the idea with that, with comics, is the script, if like something like on, like with Dave, if you're working on Star Trek or something like that, where if you're so adherent to the script, you're missing out on the actual like benefit of comics and the kind of creation that happens in between that. And even if you are a writer artist doing it, it's important to do a script for yourself. I was just, someone was tweeting about that earlier. I don't remember who was someone, but like she will always write a script and she struggles with it, but she knows she has to write a script because again, that lays out at least the framework and then you can creatively move between that. But if you don't do it, then you're just all over the place. But like, if you're so adherent to it, that, and that's obviously why Stanley was so great, because he just wouldn't write scripts and he would just give them to people and they could creatively just go wherever they want.
Yeah, you know, my favorite thing about Stan Lee was just how in tune with the comics creative process he was, how he just really understood that, you know, when you're an editor and you're not a writer, but your boss is married to your cousin, which makes you this weird kind of nephew style character, that you can just bend all the rules in the, you know, the company and just take credit for everything and put your name on stuff. And it's the best, really. I mean, I just love that guy, you know. I just think that Stan Lee just really broke the mold. They don't make them like that anymore, you know. They don't make them like that anymore. Excelsior, I say. Enough said.
Remember when he said Tony Stank? That was... you guys cover a topic in it, but I won't explore, like, obviously no spoilers and stuff like that, but with any kind of art story, there's always there's an underlying idea of ownership and where that is in art, whether it be Becca and Tulip, what her say is in that, or the general idea of Tulip, where did that come from? Approaching that in this book, and obviously being artists yourselves, the importance of that kind of working into the book, and like you said, kind of your own experiences of like the culmination of that in this story. I don't know if there's a question there, but like I found it interesting, especially the two of you who have done stuff like, you know, Shitty Watchmen, and obviously we joke about Stan Lee, but kind of really taking the, you guys are kind of generally big on the creator movement front of freedom with that and the individuality of that. And tackling something like this in the story where there is not only the idea of ownership within who owns it, does like Becca's agency in that, but also the kind of general idea of Tulip, where does it come from? And at that point, does everyone own the idea of Tulip, and can that transcend beyond that and anyone use it, I guess, per se? So kind of a big important part of this in your experience as an artist.
Yeah. I think there's like 15 answers that I could give to everything you just said. So I'm going to give one or two, and then I'll let Nicole give the rest of the 15. I think part of the thing that you just broke down of like ownership and kind of creative authenticity is something that's really important to both of us. I think, you know, both of us are interested in comics as a formal medium. Not a fucking genre, because it's not a fucking genre. It's a goddamn medium. I think we're also both very aware of the history of the medium and how it has mistreated people. And so owning the work that you create is very important. And I think there's also something to be said with the fact that a lot of creative industries struggle with that same issue of equitable compensation for creative labor, because it's a perennial topic everywhere in our culture. Equitable compensation for any labor is a topic that feels like it's just omnipresent. To talk about a second, as the second answer, what you were talking about in kind of like the origin or the nature of artistic compromise, and can everyone be Tulip? That I think comes from a deeply autobiographical place. Like during a lot of the interviews that we've been doing, people have pointed out that Becca is from Arizona and that I'm from Arizona, which is very true. But to me, that's not particularly autobiographical. That's just something I didn't have to research. That's something I can write about very easily. Whereas the stuff that we're talking about, the nature of compromise, artistic collaborations, potentially pulling you into something that you're not comfortable with, navigating the business side of any sort of artistic industry, that is deeply autobiographical and deeply emotionally something I'm interested in examining.
Yeah, I mean, I would obviously second everything you just said. We've been through numerous instances where we had to sort of make decisions about whether we wanted to take an opportunity and maybe move up in the industry or not take it and hold on to our values in terms of creator ownership or what we ideally wanted to make or this or that. So there's definitely stuff in the book that comes from our experiences as cartoonists would translate to basically every artistic medium. How do you put food on the table? How do you pay your bills while still being able to make something that is genuine and an expression of yourself? Because unless you're a fine art painter, and even if you're a fine art painter, we all work in commercial industries. The point is to sell books, but you want to find a way to sell books and tell stories that you care about. And it can be really hard. You know, sometimes making those decisions, A, is very stressful, and B, there is no right answer. You don't know which way is right, and you kind of just have to decide where your personal line is. And then the other factor is this idea of everyone can be Tulip, and what's the line between stealing and reappropriation in art? And it's something that I've been thinking about a lot, even more so now, because when we started making this book, I think TikTok was like maybe just starting to be a thing, but memes were a thing, and obviously YouTube was a thing. But now I'm mostly on Instagram watching TikTok or Reels, and so much of the format of those social media platforms is literally reusing other people's audio, reusing other people's videos, reacting to other people's videos. And you can make an entire public persona that's based just on lip syncing to something that someone else made. So that line for everyone, because there is no bar to entry anymore, has been lowered so low that we really, I think, need to start asking these questions of what is okay. Is the term reappropriation something that was made specifically to excuse stealing? Or when you add something and you say something different, does it make it okay? Are you changing the meaning of the original thing? And I think, you know, you look at the videos that we see on TikTok, some of them are adding to the conversation. They're telling a new story with something that already exists. And some of them are just doing the same thing with their own face. Like, this is literally that you didn't add anything to this. So it's something that I think that we as a culture need to grapple with and kind of make some decisions on. And I don't know that that's going to happen anytime soon, but it's worth talking about.
Nicole, would you say that this issue that seemingly affects everyone means that everyone is Tulip? Would you say that?
Would I say that? I don't know if I would say that. Would I say that? You think I would say that?
Would you say that?
I don't know. Like, I'm not sure about that.
Would you say everyone is Stan Lee? Would you say that?
I might say everyone is Stan Lee.
Ay!
Ay, ay!
No, there was only one Stan Lee. He's dead. He's fucking dead. His nurse killed him. I don't fucking know. Two quick things I want to hit on, and then I'll let Tim do his final question. I don't want to keep you guys here forever.
I do.
One, yeah. This is Tim always intimidates me when we do video. That's why we don't do video, because he's always like,
it's the angle. I'm not actually this big.
Yeah, your questions are like, I don't know.
You look really
tall. The beard takes up so much of the screen that, you know.
Yeah, I know your height in real life, but you look really tall on this stream.
I think you're about my height, right?
Yeah, a little shorter.
Really? You know, I have to, like, stay away from playground mustache. But we talked about how this is a very kind of character-driven book. I mean, I think it goes without saying this is all about the journey. But you guys juggle quite a few arcs, and I think, again, beautifully done so. I don't think anyone's left out. I think everyone kind of has their moment in the sun. But also, like, it is a very real story in that, I mean, outside Chloe, maybe, everyone has faults. And even obviously she has her own faults, but, like, I think everyone is almost borderline unlikable at times, and then other times relatable. And I think that's generally people. Like, most people are unlikable because myself am unlikable, but I have moments, and, like, that is life. Is that, I always say that, difficult, but, like, a book that hinges on that so much, how do you guys kind of toe that line of a character that makes decisions that make you uncomfortable, but at the same time, like, you kind of want to root for them or do that? How do you approach that as creators?
That was a big discussion. Yeah. Mm-hmm. The book went through a few different versions. Some of them where the characters were a little bit more, maybe dark, maybe would be a good way to describe it. I'm of the school of, can it be sadder always? That's just my general approach to making comics is just like, yeah, but what's the saddest thing that could happen right now?
Oh, yeah, I make the argument of, is it sad if you don't care about the character?
Yeah. Yeah.
You gotta build the empathy before you make the sad things happen to them.
Yeah.
But yes, it went through a couple passes.
Yeah, it went through various versions, and Nicole was actually one that she added a couple scenes earlier in the book between Becca and Eve to really show their friendship developing and show that they were close and it wasn't purely antagonistic all the time, that they really did care for each other. It's interesting to me kind of which characters people zero in on and which characters people kind of delineate as like, oh, they kind of went too far, or oh, that character was kind of shitty, or whatever it is. Because like you said, Kyle, like, everybody in the book kind of has their positives and negatives.
Except for Petey, he's only positive.
Yeah, except for Pete. I love that guy.
He's the best.
He's the best. I don't think Nicole and I are allowed to like our own characters as much as this, but we both really like that little dude. He's really funny to us. Which kind of really started during the character designing phase, because Nicole did a drawing of Chloe and Petey just like standing there, and we were both like, I don't know who the fuck these people are, but these people, let's make a fucking book about these two.
Well, Chloe went through like probably the most different character designs before I landed on that. And when I drew that, I was like, well, no more drawings. This is it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's weird how you can just kind of feel that sometimes. I was just going to say, it's weird how you can sometimes feel like, oh, this is the one. Like, that's the thing where you just kind of find gold. Where you're just like, oh, this is it. We don't have to keep searching anymore.
Do you think how Stan Lee felt like every day, coming up with a new brilliant idea?
I don't. Oh, I hate this so much.
You don't have to answer that, Dave.
I think Stan Lee.
A disingenuous question.
I think Stan Lee worked with a lot of really talented people that didn't get credit. That's what I think.
Tim, he made Spider-Man, right?
I like that he's frozen in this weird kind of smug, like,
smelling his own shit. For my last question, again, a lot of the book focusing kind of, again, on the idea of social media, how it affects us, and like our active part in it. Again, both of you are artists and creators in comics, which means you have to actively do all your own promoting and legwork, hence why you're talking to losers like me and Tim. So,
but I love both of you. I love both of you. You're not losers.
Well, we could be losers and you love us. That's
aww.
A and B. Okay. But how is that, as creators, just talking about that, like what, something that always boggles me, and we've talked about it as a bunch on the show, but it still seems like it, how much of the industry is you guys making, again, I mean, Dark Horse obviously does what they do, but still, it falls on you two. And even when we were talking to Nicole, like, that's a DC book, but still, it was like Sarah and Nicole out there doing it. And then occasionally, Nicole would show up drawing and running all over kids. Like, besides that, like, it's crazy that that's kind of the industry, but like, how much of the day is you guys just making sure you're relevant on social media so that people are buying your books?
Like, most of it. I mean, we do get help from the publishers, obviously. When I did Batgirl, we had like a week where Sarah and I went into the DC offices and did like a full run of interviews, and they got us some really great stuff. But, you know, we had a signing, a book release party at a local bookstore that Sarah goes to all the time, and she organized that entire thing. We had like 150 people there. It was like this great big wonderful party, which Sarah basically put together all on her own. And for Tulip, we have Dark Horse setting up some interviews, making some contacts, doing some kind of initial art releases, stuff like that. But Dave has spent the last couple of weeks just emailing so many people to try and get our book out there, emailing retailers, emailing podcasts to do stuff like this. That's the reason we're doing the online release of the book, the webcomic version. And there is a lot where it's, you could just let your publisher do what they're gonna do, put your ads in the back of the rest of their books, set up a couple interviews, but you're not gonna sell very many books that way. You really have to do that and put your all into marketing it, as well as just staying relevant throughout the year, especially when you're working on a long form book like this, where it's not coming out every month and people forget you're around. You have to constantly remind them, like, hey, I'm still here, make things, promise.
Yeah, I have no real conception of how effective any of the stuff I've done has been yet, but I'm gonna go down swinging, baby.
Right.
I'm pretty sure that was dialogue for Spider-Man by Stan Lee, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep.
It probably was at some point.
Yeah, with great power comes great. With I'm going down swinging, baby. It's funny too that you keep bringing up Stan Lee and Spider-Man, because of all of them, I think the best case that you could make for like Stan kind of having an impact would be Spider-Man. You know, like if I mean, I love Steve Ditko. He's like my fucking favorite. Spider-Man would be very different if it was just Steve Ditko. You know what I mean? Like it would be a very different thing. I would probably like it more, but I don't know that everyone else would. You're the only person. Yeah, yeah. Man, the dude's fucking dead, and I still back his Kickstarters, man. Like, come on. I'm ride or die with that crazy objectivist kook. I love that guy.
And from what I know, Steve Ditko loves you, so I mean.
Oh, yeah. We wrote letters back and forth, man. We exchanged letters. Yeah, I have three of them.
He consistently told you to go away.
I mean, it's still letters. He still wrote me letters.
You got a signature.
I mean, honestly, if it's like the relationship I have with my kids, then yeah, like, I love my kids, but get the fuck out of here. Leave me alone. So, like, it's not, he probably saw you as a, like, his kid.
When I sent him that Action Hospital collection and he wrote me back, I have nor the time nor the effort to evaluate this. I shall pass it along to someone who does. That was his version of saying, I love you, son.
Yeah.
That is like getting the drawing when they come home from school and you're like, yep.
Putting it on the refrigerator now. Mm-hmm. Good job, Timmy.
I should use that line from the amount of like emails we get for people to look at books. I have neither the time or effort to look at this book. But since Tim has now ruined the podcast, I'll let Tim end it with his final question.
So, gun to your heads, if you had to write one episode of Two and a Half Men, what would happen?
My I have a pitch for this, but I'm gonna freely admit I have never seen an episode of Two and a Half Men. So allow me to pitch you what I think Two and a Half Men is, and then I'll pitch you the episode. From public awareness, I think it's about an odd couple of two brothers who live together with one of their sons, I think. And their son is like a kid. He's like 10 or whatever. And one of them is like a, he's, don't take my fucking pitch, bro. So he's like a little kid or whatever, right? And there's like the good parent who's probably the actual biological parent. And then there's like the uncle who's like the bad boy who I think is probably Charlie Sheen. My pitch is the season finale of the last season of Two and a Half Men, a bomb goes off and the little kid loses his legs. And it's this kind of Born in America style, political, or Born on the Fourth of July, very, very hyper liberal anti-war thing. But the end of it is them in the hospital and they're nursing the little kid back to life who has no legs. And Charlie Sheen turns the camera and goes, "It truly was Two and a Half Men." That's my pitch.
There's no way I can top that. So, you know. I also literally have never seen it.
I've never seen it. I don't know anything about it other than I think Charlie Sheen got fired.
I think you were close? Question mark.
Is that what it is about? I don't even know. Is it?
Good day. Yeah, we're pretty sure that's what it's about.
We don't know either.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure. Yeah.
I would do. Charlie Sheen takes the kid to SPX, and the kid decides he wants to make mini comics for a living, and the dad is really upset because his kid will never make a living.
I love that idea so much more than my. See, my pitch was too primary. It was too on the nose. Your pitch, esoteric, sad in a completely different way. And you can get cameos from a bunch of cool cartoonists who all True. Can say stuff like, "Don't do it, kid. Comics will break your heart."
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like The Simpsons got Alan Moore. And who was that one? Neil Gaiman and
Art Spiegelman and somebody else, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, Neil Gaiman was on Arthur, so it can't be that hard. Yeah, nothing to do.
That's what I'm saying, baby.
So if anyone wants to know more about you and the book, what's the best way they could do that?
You can read more of the book at everyoneistulip.com. You can buy the book in comic book stores June 16, 8 days from now. You can buy it in bookstores June 29, 21 days from now. You can follow me on TikTok, Instagram, and Twitter at xDaveBakerX, or you can listen to my podcast, Deep Cuts, which is an explainer podcast where we walk the listener through the ins, the outs, and the nitty-gritty of an obscure topic so they can appear like an interesting and idiosyncratic person at their next forced social function. Do a lot of weird stuff. We had a whole musical about Napster, 2.5 hours, 11 original songs. Nicole!
You can find me at my website, which is just nicolegu.com, on Twitter at nicolegu and Instagram at ngu. And to spell my name correctly, it is G-O-U-X.
Fancy.
It's too fancy. So fancy. Yeah. It's French, so it must be fancy.
Exactly. They're cultured people like us. Yeah. Americans. Yeah. Tim, where are you?
I write puff pieces about Steve Aoki over at Comics Pit, and I'm on Twitter and Instagram at Tim Madera.
Have you tried to do an interview with Steve Aoki yet? Like, have you tried to talk to that guy about his Digital Butterflies comic yet?
No, but I found out somebody I'm acquaintances with does, like, the visuals for some EDM DJ, and he posted a video of him at watching Steve Aoki play the other night, so I was like, I have an in. I can do this.
Yeah, that's a real in. Yeah, a dude you know knows a dude who went to a Steve Aoki concert. Oh, man. This is going to be the interview of a lifetime.
Just you wait.
I am waiting because I remember last time you did an interview with the company that published that shitty Steve Aoki Digital Butterflies comic, and you totally wussed out and were just like, so what's it like running a really great comic book company that published great comics like Steve Aoki's Butterflies Revenge? And I've never forgiven you.
I know, you mention it every day.
Was it? Who put that book out?
There's some shitty IP farm company made by a...
I don't remember the name.
Yeah, yeah. It's a guy that made... energy bars. He was like a energy bar magnate. He made like $1 billion in energy bars and was like, I'm going to get into the IP farming business. Steve Aoki, let's make a comic. I'm going to get Jim Kruger to write it and some guy in the Philippines to draw it.
That's almost as good as a company that started out making plumbing ware.
Oh, yeah, Aircell. Yeah. Yeah, in the
80s. I thought that was Fawcett.
No.
That's two on the nose.
No. Fawcett was not. They didn't do that. They just ripped off Superman and then went bankrupt because DC sued them.
This all sounds like a bad idea.
It does sound like a bad idea.
And then the graphic comes up sponsored by Bad Idea.
Yeah. That's
which is
I don't know, actually.
No
I
longer going to be around. Right?
One out for. I never know how to
pour
say
one
it.
Out for Bad Idea.
Oh no!
Really though,
no,
pour one out for PO.
I was just about to say that, and especially because I always want to. I don't know why we did the interview with Al Gaffa, and I'm like, I always say Piao Piao, and it's not. It's just one, but it's so fun. One.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
Yeah, and
it's all of their. It's all of their initials. It's Patrick something 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 something. The other guys, I only know Patrick.
Yeah, they put out some of the best fucking books. Very sad.
I completely agree. Completely agree. Rest in peace, Piao. Your books are way too good for this earth.
But you'll be joined by a Bad Idea soon enough, apparently.
Bro, you know that's not true. They're not going under. That's a
they
fucking.
They said it, Dave. They have released multiple things that said they're done. What am I supposed to believe here?
The opposite of anything Dinesh says. That guy is not going to tell you the truth, bro.
Well, I don't know what to believe anymore. It's like some world where everyone is Tulip. But yes, and we are a fucking podcast about comic books. You know where we are. You don't stumble upon them. If you're listening to this, I think it might be out before Friday's episode of Greatest Comic Book of All Time that I read this week with Kyle and Jack is out. So I'm be joined by Marvel writer Jed McKay, who writes Black Cat and other robotic books or something there. I don't know what he does. But Jed's fun. We're going to be talking about, I should be more, propose my guess, Hobtown Mystery Stories, The Case of the Missing Men, which is like a small publisher book from Nova Scotia. I think Conundrum Press. I hadn't heard about this book. He picked it. It's fucking dope. It's like David Lynch meets like Hardy Boys. It's fucking great. And I'm picking Spider-Man Spirits of the Earth, but you can tune in live Friday for that. But, you got fucking, dude, that book is insane. It's so good. There's a new one out.
That's mine. Oh, wait, no, that's not what I thought it was. No, I thought it was a different
Did
book.
You get the crab Sorry. One?
Did I get the what one?
There's a new one out. It's like crab something.
No, I
crab
have not. Posts? I have not. No, I have not. I have not gotten the new one, but I love the art in it. It's so fucking rad.
Yeah, I'm about halfway through already because Jed asked me if we could do it this morning, and I've read it. It's fucking great. But
yeah, it's really good.
Yeah. Thank you guys so much. The most important thing, go pick up. What's the format? Is this going to be – what's the size
of it?
It's
a standard size comic, 10.67 by 8.39 or whatever the fuck the standard dimension trade is.
6.25. By 10.25, I believe.
See, that's where you're getting. You're getting that 6x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x10x
And I promised him next time we'll be able to talk about some George Lopez. And I keep doing it to you, buddy, but year and a half. We'll get there.
One day. One day.